Just a note before we begin the show. Today's episode features descriptions of capital punishment as well as police brutality. If that's not something you feel comfortable hearing about today, then please take a break or skip to our next episode. So we're looking at a photograph from Kenya's first institutional hanging, as per the inscription on the back of the photograph. In the center, the main kind of image are these wooden makeshift gallows. And even as I say makeshift, I'm just like, what is makeshift and what is not makeshift? But there's this gallows, this wooden gallows that are steeped in sand. That tells me this must be at the coast. This palm tree is another marker for the coast. What I'm noticing for the first time now is five men hanging. I've only ever seen two when I've looked at this, but now that I look at it closely, I can see that there's actually like a whole row of maybe four or five men who are hanging with this pieces of cloth wrapped around their waist. And then around them, kind of like in the foreground, is this white man who's standing right in front of the gallows, kind of looking down in a way. And what's even more chilling is that these three other, well, I can see two other gentlemen that look like they're dressed like members of the King's African Rifle.
And oddly dressed in full white.
Well, it could also be like khaki, who knows. There's actually three men. You can see a third guy, a third askari.
At the back there.
At the back, yeah. I have so many questions about who took this photograph and why. Well, not the why. I'm grateful they did because now we know. But yeah. like, these men look so young. At least the one in the front. Like, he barely looks 20. I think of all the photos we found, and we found a lot in the library while digitizing the archive, this one really stands out. Obviously, it's a subject matter. It's particularly upsetting, enraging, but it's also the way that it's posed. Like, every time I look at it, I just want to see those men's faces. Like, I want to go back into history and identify them. Who are they? How did they end up at those gallows? Is there any record of them being there? And if there is, does it still exist? And that's sort of the thing about history. We're unearthing these images decades, many decades later, and we don't have much to go on.
All we have is the inscription on the back.
And that does tell us something, of course. It tells us that whoever took this or whoever catalogued it thought that was the most important thing about it. Kenya's first institutional hanging. Like that. That's the most important part of it. The beginning of something. Like, we're going to do more of these, so let's just get that first one down for the record.
But it doesn't really tell us anything that we want to know. Why were they subjected to this? What was the crime they supposedly committed?
I can start with the things I do know, or rather, what history tells us we know. That the death penalty was introduced by the British colony in 1893, as part of the colonial penal code.
A penal code, or a criminal code, is a document that sets out crimes and penalties for said crimes.
Mm-hmm. And previously, before the empire, Kenya and Kenyans didn't have a penal code. Different communities had different belief systems and different ways of dealing with community members who were seen to endanger the community. Today, we call this a number of things: traditional law, customary law, indigenous law.
There were forms of justice, ways of delivering justice in what we might call, in quote, African traditional societies. My name's Ochieng Luke Sahaya. I'm a senior lecturer at Masinde Muliro University of Science and Technology, that is in Western Kenya. Pre-colonial Africa, the kind of justice that was meted out was always such that it was not the winner-take-it-all kind of justice. It was the kind of justice where it restored, instead of creating an enmity, created a situation where there was mutual feeling. I am because you are because I am kind of situation.
Today, this kind of justice has a new and fancy name, restorative justice. based on input from those affected by the crime rather than imposed only by the state. It's gained traction with many human rights organizations all over the world.
That is one big difference between the traditional or indigenous ways of African justice compared to the Western. I use the term that the indigenous law in Africa had the ability to scratch where it itched, which I think contemporary law or the Western law that is now the predominant does not do.
And that justice, or lack thereof, was enshrined in the British Penal Code. The laws we have today, the ones that come from the British Penal Code, they didn't actually start with Kenya, because we all know it wasn't just Kenya that they colonized.
It was a far-reaching empire.
Mm-hmm, indeed it was. And the first place the British thought, we should do some civilizing and we need some laws to do it. That place was India.
I did a fair amount of research on the history of the Kenyan Penal Code and where these very strange laws came from. And what it turns out is that the British adopted a penal code for India that was really sort of a white supremacist experiment. And it was this notion that these people needed to be civilized and that a penal code that was rational and made sense and was clear would be something that would help civilize this community.
This is Chris Keckering.
I'm currently the litigation manager at Katiba Institute. And so then that code was transplanted to other British colonies, including Kenya. And so the Kenyan penal code is very, very similar to what was originally developed for India. And among that was the mandatory death penalty, and that was for murder.
Today, we're talking about capital punishment. As Chris says, capital punishment was brought in pretty early in the colonial government's rule as punishment for murder. It didn't stay that way, though.
Before independence, that broadened.
I can guess why.
And you would be right.
It broadened largely as a response to Mao and to independence movements. So suddenly you began to see that you were getting stricter sentences for even things like taking oaths or announcing your allegiance to specifically Mao Mao, but really to any organization that was either critical of or acting against the colonial forces. And the death penalty became a major tool in the arsenal to challenge and to undermine independence movements in Kenya.
We don't have the exact number of people that were hung while Kenya was under colonial rule. We all know the British were great at keeping records, but also pretty good at destroying them.
Mm-hmm.
However, researchers figure that during the Mau Mau uprising, that number was in the thousands.
And here in this picture, I think we see five.
Yep, just in this one picture. And this is far before that time.
And Kenya, I think, still has the death penalty now, right?
Yep, it does. The mandatory death penalty is one of those laws that kind of hung around and stuck when Kenya declared independence. But it didn't just hang around. It got stricter, much stricter, actually.
After independence, you saw the mandatory death penalty expand to cases of robbery with violence and to cases of attempted robbery with violence. Part of that, I think, was because the tensions that generated the Mau Mau Rebellion did not go away when colonialism left. They just kind of took on a different form. But you also had then this desire to maintain power. So you were seeing what was perceived by authorities as an attempt to unjustly take what belonged to the people in power as an offense that was worth somebody being killed.
I mean, do many countries have the death penalty for attempted robbery?
Very few. Kenya's really an outlier.
So it's still on our books, in our legal code, that's common knowledge. But Kenya doesn't still execute people, right?
You're right. Kenya is referred to as a de facto abolitionist state when it comes to the death penalty. there hasn't been an execution for 35 years, which is what that means, that the country hasn't executed anybody in a while. The last people the state executed were Hezekiah Ochuka and Pancras Oteo Okumu.
For their role?
In the 1982 attempted coup. Mm. They were executed in 1987, but that doesn't mean that the sentence isn't still handed down.
The fact that there hasn't been an execution, it does not mean that the death penalty is not a very vibrant and live thing. What we're really saying when we say it's sort of de facto abolitionist is that we're crossing our fingers that the government will not actually act on the authority it has to kill these thousands of people.
There are at least 600 people in prison who have been sentenced to death, and we're talking mostly robbery here. Organizations like the Katiba Institute, where Chris works, are fighting to abolish the death penalty altogether.
What we're really focusing on is the fact that if you have a mandatory death penalty, what you're saying is that the individual who's being sentenced to death doesn't matter. So the individual circumstances of a crime, the circumstances of a person who may have committed that crime are irrelevant to the consequence of the conviction. And under the Constitution, you have a right to a fair trial, and that right cannot be limited by the government. What the courts have said, and this is consistent with courts around the world, is that the right to a fair trial isn't just about the right to fairness during the guilt or innocence part of a trial, but actually also extends to the sentencing part. And that if you are going to have a fair trial, you need to be able to present what they call aggravating and mitigating factors. So you need to be able to say, this is who I am, and this is why when the judge makes a decision about the sentence, they should exercise discretion and impose a sentence that reflects who I am, not just what I did. So we've been successful with the courts in arguing that because the death penalty here was mandatory, it was unconstitutional. However, that doesn't mean that the death penalty is off the table. What we are now looking at doing is trying to push the argument that the Constitution's balancing of rights and fundamental freedoms, and when it's appropriate to limit a right, such as the right to life, that if you are to balance the interests that are involved, then through the Constitution, you have to come to the conclusion that the death penalty cannot be practiced here in Kenya. Those are very technical arguments, and in some respects, they don't resonate with people. And so the other thing that we're trying to do is we're trying to really sort of explain to people that sentencing and criminal law are not very good ways to affect public policy. And when you look at what is behind things like the death penalty, it is a notion that somehow that's going to reduce the amount of violence or the amount of murder or other violent crime in the country. And we just don't have data to support that.
Being strict on crime is seen as a way to lower the amount of crime being done. And it's something that makes sense if you just hear it.
But there have been many, many studies that show that strict sentencing doesn't deter people from criminal activity.
Mm-hmm. And Kenya, or at least part of Kenya, the state, sees itself as being strict on crime.
Certain crimes?
Certain crimes, exactly. This doesn't just extend to the criminal code and the courts. Like when I say the word execution to you, Ashuka, you do think of the courts first?
Not so much.
Six police officers were charged with murder on Thursday for the deaths of two brothers in August, which led to accusations of brutality against law enforcement officials.
Kenyan police on Tuesday fired tear gas and detained protesters demanding an end to police brutality.
You're probably thinking of a different state apparatus. And remember earlier you were saying how you couldn't really remember the last time somebody was executed by hanging in
right.
Kenya.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure you could think about the last time recently that somebody was killed by the police.
Yes. I think specifically in the early days of the pandemic, for instance, so much was happening there regarding police brutality. Specifically around the mask mandate.
Oh my gosh, exactly, yep.
And then, of course, it was also the time where we started to see a lot of news coverage around Black liberation movements across the world.
Mm-hmm.
So to answer your question, yeah, it's in the news constantly. We hear about it all the time.
Yep. And exactly like the courts, the origins of Kenya's police force are in colonial Kenya.
The function of that force was to protect the colonial government and their interests at that time. And they did not have the interests of the local community in their heart.
Dr. Douglas Lucas Kivoe has a PhD in ethics and African philosophy, and he works with the Kenya Institute for Public Policy and Research Analysis.
I'm a researcher and also a policy analyst in governance in general. But my main area of interest has been on policing in Kenya and also in neighboring countries. That is how I come into interaction with this project, because policing has been a big thorn in the flesh of citizens of this country since the time of colonialism.
Even some of the offenses are old colonial offenses, like loitering. What does that even mean? Or even drunk and disorderly? Those were offenses that were just put there.
Criminalizing being African in an area that they thought you should not be in.
Yep. And it was one of these interactions with police that spurred Dr. Kivoe into focusing on police reform.
One day I was walking in Nakuru and then they arrested me for being drunk and disorderly. And that was around 5 years ago. No, was it 5 or 7 years ago? It was not a good encounter. They did not take me to court. They asked me to pay a bribe. And it's raining. So you are supposed to pay. And also, as we talk about the issue of policing, you also need to understand why many Kenyans pay that bribe. Our detention facilities, police facilities, resemble pens of animals. Hygiene in those facilities is pathetic. The so-called police cells, they are not... they are not hospitable to any human being. Even my own cows cannot sleep in some of those facilities that they are used to house human beings. So I'm interested in the rule of law and policing because I have seen a lot of poor men and women suffer at the hands of police because they cannot afford a bribe. What happens if you cannot pay a bribe? If you're a poor person, you are on your own and you are God if you believe that it's God. So that's the interest. That's what made me develop interest in that, because we never treat poor people in this country as human beings, especially when they are encountering police officers.
And again, like the courts, Dr. Kivoe says that the police force became a tool of the new rulers after independence.
A lot of things went wrong after Kenya got independence, because now we see the police service or police force that was inherited from colonial government turn now into a tool for political repression. Remember in the late 60s, when there was a massacre of people in Kisumu, police officers shot into crowds and killed so many people. We see again, when we have the second president, Daniel Toroitich Arap Moi, we see the police service again was a tool for repression. It was used to settle scores. Those who are opposed to the government of the day at that time, the police were the ones who were used to arrest, torture, maim, engage in all forms of human rights violations. Because since independence, we have had a police force that only works for the ruling elites.
Dr. Kivoe says we badly need police reform.
I think we all think that.
The training given to our police officers is problematic. It is a military-like, paramilitary training, not a police training. It's a paramilitary training. So how do you expect paramilitary forces to enforce law and order in communities? We have got this extortion whereby officers will arrest people to extort money from them. Mostly it happens on Fridays and Saturdays. Young men are rounded up and taken to police cells where they are supposed to pay bribes. Foreigners are normally given special preference as opposed to local communities. And I'm not saying that foreigners should have their rights violated. I'm just saying I've seen foreigners given special preference than our own brothers and sisters in this country. Cases of extrajudicial killings, cases of kidnappings, those are things that cases of forced disappearance, those people just vanish in air. They drop out of the map of Kenya, nobody knows where they are. you arrest people or you kidnap someone, throw them in. Then after a week or a month, they are found dead in Roblox vehicles in a forest.
Whew. I know. It's a lot.
And there's a lot to reform.
I think when we talk about reform, and this is why we spoke to Dr. Kivoy and Chris Keckering, is to get back to what Dr. Ahaya said at the top of the podcast. What does community-centered justice even look like? Dr. Ahaya did say that way back before the British came, there were norms that communities would look to for more restorative justice.
But they did come, and they did bring those laws, and successive governments have kept them.
And they're working in the exact way that they're supposed to protect a small number of people at the very top of society.
We need to transform policing into a people-centered institution. We need to remove police officers from our highways. It's because those roadblocks are used as extortion points. We must also ensure that we give police officers a good working environment, offices, housing units that are suitable, transport vehicles, medical insurance. Lower-ranking officers must also ensure that their seniors are not asking them to engage in criminal activities. And that one is an effort that can come from within, because what I know is as long as police officers are not willing to change, all these efforts that are being done will be efforts in futility. And then we ask those who engage in human rights violations to be held accountable for their acts, because the National Police Service Act says that an individual who breaks the law in the name of enforcing an order from a senior officer will be held liable. Even if you've been arrested for a crime, you still have your rights. You should not be tortured, you should not be shot, you should not be brutalized, you should not be treated in an indignifying way. Your human dignity still remains even if you have committed a crime. We should never keep a blind or turn a blind eye on a rogue policing institution.
You know, we didn't even do an intro at the beginning, but I want to do it here. I'm Onjiro Koinange.
And I am Angela Washuka.
This is A Palace for the People,
a podcast about what Kenya's past tells us about Kenya's present.
And hopefully help us think about what we need to do for our future. This episode was produced by me, Onjiro Koinange, Angela Washuka, Maeve Francis, and Ida Holinambi. This is a Fathom Sirens production. You can learn more about our work at bookbank.org.
This podcast is supported by the Cultural Protection Fund, a partnership between the British Council and the UK Government's Department for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport. Thanks for listening.